Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to Daniel McCool, who is the editor of The Most Fundamental Right, Contrasting Perspectives on the Voting Rights Act. I hope that you enjoy the interview.
Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I have the real pleasure to talk with Dan McCool. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Heath. How are you?
Great. Dan, you're the author of The Most Fundamental Right, which I really enjoyed reading.
Thank you.
Before we get to the actual book, I'm always very interested in sort of what came before this publication. I wonder if you could talk maybe just a little bit about yourself and about where this book comes from. I know that you've written on the subject matter before.
But this is either my eighth or ninth book, depending on how you count the last two have came out simultaneously. And the other books on river restoration has absolutely nothing to do with the Voting Rights Act. So I have two very disparate sets of interests. A previous book that I co-authored with a colleague and a graduate student was called Native Vote, and it looked at Voting Rights Act cases in Indian country and analyzed about 72 Voting Rights Act cases where the plaintiffs were American Indians. I've been writing about Indian voting rights for quite some time, but that led to a larger interest in the Voting Rights Act, which was renewed in 2006. And the renewal, even though there were very lopsided majorities, in fact, in the Senate it was unanimous, there was a very spirited debate over the future of the Voting Rights Act, with a focus primarily on Section 5, but also Section 203. Section 5 is the section that requires pre-clearance for covered jurisdictions, and Section 203 is the language assistance section. And it was a fascinating debate, and that I'm actually the editor of The Most Fundamental Right. As I saw this debate developed, and I actually took part in it in a very small way. I thought it was a fascinating discussion of fundamental issues in the United States. So how do we define democracy and fair elections, and what's the role of race, and how has America changed, and how do we draw district boundary lines that have a tremendous impact on who can and cannot win elections? These are really important issues.
And I have to say before I got the book, you know, my impression of the Voting Rights Act was that it was obviously a very significant part of the civil rights legislation, but that this was something that was sort of technical and procedural and wasn't juicy in the ways that you describe. And I think one of the really interesting things about the book is exactly as you say, that how fundamental these issues are and how they may have changed over time. That is much of the subject of the many of the articles, but the issues haven't gotten any less interesting over the last 40-odd years. How did you put this together in terms of choosing the authors for the various sections? You set this up as sort of mini debates on different issues. Were these authors that you had worked with before? How did you go about making these kinds of choices?
In looking at the debate over the 2006 renewal, which took place over a period of, I believe, about 9 months, I paid close attention to who the leading voices were on both sides of the debate. I've been involved in some of the Voting Rights Act cases in Indian country as an expert witness, so I knew a couple of the leading voices. But the debate exposed me to people on both sides of this issue, and there's several several books out on the VRA, but what's unique about this book is that it is a debate in print. And the authors of the various sections are paired in opposition to each other. So I went out looking for the leading voices on both sides of the debate, and I think I found them. For example, the Shelby County case will be oral arguments are tomorrow before the U.S. Supreme Court. The attorney arguing in favor of Section 5 coverage there is Dibo Adegbole. He's the author of the last chapter in the book.
I didn't even realize that.
Yes, and he is paired in the book against Edward Bloom. Edward Bloom is the president of the Project on Fair Representation, which brought the Shelby County case.
Mm-hmm.
So, these people are very much involved in this debate as it continues.
Yeah, and you know, this is the sort of the timeliness in a couple of different ways. I was really struck by, you know, the most obvious of the first was the importance of voting rights and the controversy at the state level that we saw in 2012. But then following that, as if that wasn't enough, this Supreme Court taking up this case. And so maybe you could put this into a little bit of historical context for us. That's sort of what your introductory chapter does. Where did this start? You know, we sort of probably all know the facts of when this was passed, but maybe you could give just sort of the real short history of where this fits into the civil rights movement.
Yes, you mentioned the juicy issues, and at times it's difficult to talk about the Voting Rights Act without delving deeply into fairly technical legal issues, so I'll do my best to do the brief history here. When the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, it was a very dramatic, and some would say draconian, piece of legislation, but passed in response to very serious problems regarding the ability of people of color to vote. And they decided to divide the act into two different kinds of sections. There are permanent sections, and there are sections that have to be periodically renewed. And the most important permanent section is Section 2. And Section 2 outlaws discrimination in voting practices. And the standard is that minorities, or everyone really, deserves an equal opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. That's the way you go about looking at a Section 2 case. And the temporary provisions center on Section 5, principally, also Section 203, which is the language assistance provisions. But Section 5 is the focus of the Shelby County case, and it was the focus of the Austin Municipal case a couple of years ago. And that is temporary in that it has to be renewed. And over time, Congress has renewed the temporary provisions four different times. And in each case, it just happened to be signed. All the renewals happened to be signed by Republican presidents. So George W. Bush signed the 2006 renewal of the temporary provisions, and they were renewed for another 25 years. And that's the focus of so many of the court cases today is Section 5. And what that says is the Congress took a long, hard look at jurisdictions throughout the country that had a long history of racism and very concerted efforts to either prevent or deny or abridge the ability of minorities to vote. And it includes the nine states, all of them in the old Confederacy, the South, and then portions of seven other states. And it said before any of those covered, those are called covered jurisdictions, before any of those covered jurisdictions can make any changes to elections law or election procedures, it has to be approved by the U.S. Justice Department. And the reason why Congress did that is because they anticipated a large number of problematic changes that were designed to inhibit or disparage minority voting opportunities. And indeed, the Justice Department has objected to literally thousands and thousands of proposed changes in election laws. The important thing that we need to remember for Shelby County in the current debate is that those jurisdictions can bail out of the Section 5 coverage. If they have a clean record, there haven't been Section 2 cases, there haven't been a lot of Department of Justice objections, and they can clearly demonstrate that they're not making racist laws or trying to pass election changes that reduce the ability of minorities to elect candidates or the choice, they can bail out. It's actually a fairly straightforward procedure. Shelby County does not qualify for bailout because of some of the recent history there. So that's why Shelby County is still covered, and that's why they're going to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right. Where in the Department of Justice are these the preclearance or the clearance actually given? Is this the Office of Civil Rights, or is there who's in charge of this?
It's the voting section.
Okay. Now, that's one of the big pieces of it. The other big piece that you mentioned is the Section 203, which is in reference to language issues. This is probably more important today than it was in the past, just because of the immigration patterns over the last 30-odd years. Is that issue been changing in its level of controversy over time? How is that issue interact with the other issues that are more focused on African Americans, the language issue being in certain circumstances there's the need to provide translated voter information and translated ballots?
Yes. I think the Section 203 and the language provisions are more important than ever. And I have a pair of experts on Section 203 in the book. Roger Clegg argues very forcefully against the language provisions in Section 203, and James Tucker argues very passionately in favor of language assistance. And we see these language assistance cases coming up in Indian country as well as areas of the country where there are significant numbers of recent immigrants and Hispanic voters. So I think we will see more cases on Section 203. It will become increasingly important.
Yeah, I do a little work in this area, and one of the things that I've been very intrigued by is you only get this language coverage if the local community, if a certain size of language group is makes up a local community, meaning that if there's just a very small number of people speaking a certain language, they aren't given that kind of translated ballot information access, which is sort of paradoxical, because those might be the very people you would be most concerned about being disenfranchised because of their small numbers. On this, the controversy between that you present, and you present a number of them in the book. Were there any in particular that you felt like going in you were on one side, but came out feeling like, you know, my mind has been changed, or I have now seen this issue in a new way? Any, you don't have to sort of tell us which side you started and which side you ended, but any in particular that you were just struck by, you know, putting these side by side, I really can see this issue in a much clearer way than when I didn't see them put right next to each other.
Well, I certainly learned a great deal about the arguments on both sides. some VRA cases. My role in this book was as a totally neutral editor, and I wrote the first chapter of the book as neutrally as I possibly could, and I submitted it to all the other chapter authors who represent both sides on these and said, am I neutral here? Did I object, even fairly represent the issues presented by both sides? And they all agreed that I had. So I think I achieved neutrality in chapter one. Of course, that is the only chapter of the book that is not written from an advocacy perspective. The rest of them are written with either a pro or a con perspective. I think what was useful for me and what I think is useful for the readers is that it's very easy to hear just one side on the voting rights issue, and it may depend on your source of news or who your friends are or what have you. If you read this book, you will get the complete arguments on both sides by the leading advocates on both sides. So it helps one get a comprehensive and balanced interpretation of what this debate is about and what the VRA is about, and it has sort of a projection towards the future, what kind of role the VRA plays in the contemporary world. A lot of the discussion about Section 5 is, well, it's based on voting rights problems that existed in 1965, and it's a different world today. Well, what is the role of the Voting Rights Act in the contemporary world today? And I think the authors of this book do a good job of really bringing it up to date.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I couldn't agree more with the impartiality that you brought to Chapter 1 in, you know, reading about these very controversial issues. You just kept expecting there must be an opinion buried in here somewhere, and I think you did a very good, and it was very necessary given the setup of the book for the first chapter to be written in that fashion, and I know how difficult writing in that fashion is when you're so deeply enmeshed in an issue, and so I think you really did succeed, as did the authors who took on their very different challenge, which was to articulate a very specific side of each one of these arguments, and so I think it just came together in that really interesting way. What I always like to ask when someone has a new book that's come out is what's next on their horizon. And so what's next for you? Do you have a upcoming book project on this subject or another subject? What's on the horizon for you?
I do. The next project is going to be essentially a sequel to Native Vote. Native Vote was all about the effort to achieve for American Indians an equal right to vote. And there's been a long history. But most people think of the VRA, they think of the South, and they think of black voters. There has actually been a very long and persistent history of denying or abridging the vote of American Indians. And with over 70 VRA cases in Indian country, Indians now have the right to vote. And Native Vote was about the effort to get that equal right to vote. And that corresponded with a period in time when there was a dramatic effort to register Indians to vote and to get them to the polls and really utilize those newfound rights. And the next question for me is, have they been effective? Are Indians voting? There's a lot of anecdotal information that Indians have voted, that they've actually swung several elections. And I want to look at that in a systematic way to assess the efficacy of the voting rights movement in Indian country. Who's voting? At what extent? How is it compared to non-Indian voters? And what impact are they having on elections? Are they actually swinging elections? Are they having an impact on the campaigns of candidates where there are significant Indian voters? So the real politic of having the right to vote and use it.
Well, I hope that when that book comes out, and it sounds like it will come out soon, that you'll come back and talk to us about that book. In the meantime, The Most Fundamental Right, Contrasting Perspectives on the Voting Rights Act, that Dan McCool has edited, is available from Indiana University Press, both at their website. I'm sure that's also available on Amazon. Dan, thank you very much for your time today.
All right, Heath, thank you so much for talking with me.